Can you switch
up your mic?
Yes, I'll do that.
Welcome, everybody. This is the 8th lecture in our course on women in Indian Buddhism, organized by the Numota Center of Buddhist Studies and the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative, both at the University of Hamburg. And it is my great pleasure today to welcome Liz Wilson, who will speak to us on the topic of hagiographic Buddhist texts on women. Liz Wilson is a professor of comparative religion at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, where she is interim director of the Asian American Asian Studies Program and an affiliate in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program. Her training is in pre-modern South Asian religious history. Liz Wilson's research focuses on South Asian Buddhists in conversation with Hindus, Jains, and others on such topics as death and post-mortem experience, sexuality, gender, family formations, and marriage. She is author of Charming Cadavers, Horrific Figurations of the Feminine in Indian Buddhist Hagiographic Literature, Chicago 1996, and she is editor of The Living and the Dead, Social Dimensions of Death in South Asian Religion by Sunny Press 2003 and Family in Buddhism, Sunny Press 2013. So much for introduction. Now I hand over to Liz Wilson.
Thank you very much. Delighted to have the opportunity to join this group. It's a very, very nice idea. So for my talk today, I am focusing today on representations of the female body in Indian Buddhist literature of the early medieval period. My argument doesn't cover all of Buddhist literary history, but only the post-Ashokan time period. In terms of imperial history in India, post-Ashokan refers to the period after the decline of the Mauryan Empire in the 2nd century BCE. Many of the texts that I'll discuss today date to the Gupta Empire, between the 4th and the 6th centuries of the Common Era. And some of the texts that I'll refer to today date a little bit earlier during the Kushana Empire, from the 1st to the 3rd centuries of the Common Era. My interest in the gender politics of this literature began with the observation that looking at women serves as a major source of insight for men in many of the hagiographies of this era. Women's bodies seem to play a didactic role. They are a teaching tool. They're like display boards showing that physical form is subject to impermanence, that no one can escape old age, disease, and death. Women's bodies appear at key moments in hagiographies of men who have achieved great things. So they appear at moments in stories about monks, particularly monks who have struggled with sexual desire. The spectacle of the female body altered by death or disease is central to the awakening of a number of monks. And as I said, not just ordinary monks, but monks who end up being very accomplished. Often, though, at the beginning of their stories, the monks are not so accomplished. They are depicted as initially having some difficulty understanding the nature of reality, understanding that everything is impermanent and everyone is mortal. But by seeing these abstractions, things about mortality, the evanescent nature of the body, by seeing these abstractions instantiated in women's bodies, the penny drops and insight dawns. And suddenly the emotion of disgust leads the monk to finally understand in a very embodied, visceral way what he'd only vaguely conceived in an abstract way. So in these tales, the idea of embodiment is helpful on a couple of levels as we analyze these stories. first of all, women are seen by men to embody or instantiate abstract ideas like mortality. But what happens to the male spectator in these narratives is that their bodies become sites of knowing. Many of them are described as experiencing samvega, a term that's derived from a Sanskrit root meaning to tremble with emotion. Samvega can be translated as something like aesthetic shock or the agitation of recognition. So the body is brought into relief in different ways in these narratives, with different consequences for the characters portrayed. In seeing a pattern of monks looking at female bodies in post-Ashokan hagiographies, I began to wonder whether storytellers in this time period also told tales where nuns attain awakening by contemplating the bodies of men. So I looked at hagiographic narratives about nuns composed in the post-Ashokan time period, especially narratives that explain the verses attributed to nuns of the early community that are contained in the verses contained in the Teddigata. I mean, I didn't find in this text or these texts much evidence of nuns awakening by observing male bodies, but I did find something interesting that struck me as a gendering of the conventions of seeing, and that is that quite a few nuns represented in this literature achieve insight by using their own bodies as a support for meditation. Quite a few describe their bodies as sites where one can see the reality of old age, disease, death, and decay. Some of these nuns are reported to have been taught to use their bodies as a focus for meditation by monks. In other cases, the nuns were taught to use their bodies as a focus of meditation by the Buddha himself. So it seems plausible to link these narratives about women's self-observation to male perspectives on female bodies and ask how women's formation as subjects is shaped by being the object of the male gaze. I suggest that the kind of seeing that's associated with nuns in this time period is often self-referential, with nuns turning their gaze inward, viewing themselves as if in a mirror. In my analysis, I draw on feminist art and film theory, especially the idea that we can identify male and female viewing practices. I use theoretical concepts associated with the analysis of visual media to see if ideas about gendered ways of viewing painting, cinema, and other visual media can help us to think about how gender shapes literary conventions. So a word about sources. Here's an outline of the argument I'll be making today. Now on to sources. I'll focus mainly on commentarial literature in Pali, such as the Dhammapada Attakatha and Dhammapala's commentaries on the Teddigata and the Theragata. But the theme of women's bodies as display boards is not just found in Pali literature. It's found in a broad cross-section of story literature in the post-Ashokan time period. In my book, Charming Cadavers, Horrific Figurations of the Feminine in Indian Buddhist Hagiographic Literature, I discuss examples of Sanskrit texts, such as the Divyavadana and the Buddhacharita, that showcase the female body as an object lesson on impermanence. I'll mention an example today from the Buddhacharita, but would suggest if you're interested in these Sanskrit texts that you look at chapters 2 and 3 of the book for details on Sanskrit sources. Many of the narratives that I'll talk about today are linked to a specific meditation practice, a meditation practice that's meant to eradicate sexual desire. Unlike exponents of Freudian psychology, who regard sexual desire as an inherent drive, Buddhist psychologists see desire as something that is not hardwired in the brain. It's an adventitious defilement of the mind, and therefore it can be eliminated. There are a variety of meditation practices that Buddhists can use to suppress desire. But the Buddha of the Nikayas is reported to have said that the most effective means of eliminating lust is the contemplation of dead bodies in various stages of decay, a practice that's called the meditation on foulness. In Sanskrit, ashubha bhavana. In Pali, asubha bhavana. Now, to understand this practice, you first need to know that the human body is understood in Buddhist discourse as being very much like a corpse. Discourse on the body stresses its impermanence and the condition of decay that is inherent in all bodies from the moment of birth. For example, in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha describes the body as being like a boil that has gathered for many years. The apertures of the body, the bodily orifices, are like places where the boil has broken open and is leaking pus. So with these leaking apertures that exude substances like saliva, earwax, feces, etc., the body is like a boil that's always oozing. Although we can clean ourselves up and we can wipe off the things that leak out of us, we can never completely purify our bodies. So the human body is inherently filthy. Contemplating dead bodies brimming with putrefaction makes it possible to apprehend the true nature of the body and thus to eliminate the urge to unite sexually with the bodies of others. This quote from the Anguttara Nikaya suggests that observing the foul will eliminate sexual desire. The Buddha says, "Monks, I know of nothing with the power to prevent sexual desire if not already arisen, or to cause its eradication if arisen as the sign of foulness, asubha nimittam." There were special places in ancient Indian cremation grounds where the bodies of indigent persons and executed criminals were left to rot. It was there that members of the early Sangha, the early monastic order, went so that they could contemplate the foulness of the body. This form of meditation is discussed at length in doctrinal compendia such as Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga. According to Buddhaghosa, the meditator should go to a cremation ground and select corpse in one of 10 stages of decay, from the rotting corpse that's bloated with putrescence to the desiccated skeleton. Each of the 10 stages has a characteristic kind of foulness that serves as an antidote to one of 10 types of attraction to physical form. So if you're particularly invested in or prone to noticing shapely bodies, then you'll want to look at a bloated corpse. If you're particularly into noticing the complexion of skin, then you'll want to choose a discolored corpse. Here, I'll show you an image of a monk that's putting a corpse back in place. One of the 10 types of bodies that Buddhaghosa mentions is the hacked and scattered or cut and dismembered corpse that has lost its appendages in battle or in retribution for crimes. And the meditator is to gather up the dismembered parts together into a facsimile of what the body would have looked like when alive, using a stick, as this monk is using here, to avoid titillation through tactile contact. Literary depictions of this meditation practice are common in Indian Buddhist literature of the post-Ashokan period. The structure of many of these literary accounts suggest an analogy with aversion therapy, also known as shock therapy. Aversion therapy, as you may know, initially encourages inappropriate desires only to eradicate them through the introduction of painful, noxious stimuli, such as electric shock. So too, in these narratives often begin with a monk seeing a female body that arouses his desire. And then at a key moment in the narrative, that attractive female body turns into a repulsive body that discourages desire. Through the visceral experience of seeing a once desirable woman turned into a mass of putrefying or desiccated flesh, monks that are troubled by lust are able to achieve an existential awareness of the first noble truth, the dissatisfaction that dogs even the most pleasurable sensations. By acting on the body as a site of knowing, these stark encounters with decaying beauty teach the folly of lust in a very graphic and powerful way. In many of these post-Ashokan narratives that provide a literary counterpart to meditation on the fowl, the Buddha is actively involved in the process. The story of the monk Kula, for example, gives an idea of how the Buddha tends to intervene in the lives of monks. In his commentary to the Theragata, Dhammapala describes how the Buddha recommended a Subhabhavana practice to this monk, knowing the lustful ways of Kula's mind. The Buddha tells the afflicted monk to practice unceasingly. But Kula had difficulty. He continued to have lustful thoughts, even in the cremation ground. Seeing various kinds of foul corpses, he was able to perceive the sign of foulness momentarily, but when he turned his head away, he again was bothered by desire. So the Buddha perceived that Kula's insight was insufficient, and he accompanied the monk to the cremation ground one day. There, through the exercise of his psychic powers, the Buddha created an illusory display designed to eliminate Kula's lust. First, the Buddha conjured up an undecayed body of a young woman who had died quite recently and was still quite attractive. As soon as he perceived that Kula was aroused by this spectral body, the Buddha transformed it into a fly-blown corpse, with maggots pouring out from every aperture of the body. The Buddha then emitted rays of light and exhorted Kula to look deeply with a verse that's preserved in the Theragata. I'll show you that verse. So the first verse is in Kula's voice, saying he went to the cremation ground, saw a woman cast away. And then the second verse is in the voice of the Buddha, exhorting Kula to look deeply and to see the reality of the body there. The Buddha's intervention evidently worked, and Kula became an arahant, achieving the deathless state in which all desires are eliminated. In the Dhammapada Attakatha, there's another tale of a monk who is so afflicted by desire that the Buddha intervenes to teach him a lesson. Only in this case, there is a specific woman, and a rather famous one, whom the monk has fallen in love with. The Buddha uses that woman's convenient death to teach the monk a lesson about the fleeting nature of a woman's beauty. I find this narrative very interesting, because the monk himself is not given a name. He's anonymous. While the woman he falls in love with is named, and some of her story is told. This is a bit unusual. In most cases, we're not told the identity of the female bodies that monks observe. Moreover, one reason that this is an interesting narrative is that the woman's story is just a great story. Her name is Sira Ma, and the story of how she came to be a follower of the Buddha is one of my favorite narratives. It involves a great deal of drama. At the beginning of her story, Sirima is depicted as a bit of a hothead, and she flares up in jealous rage against another woman, and she tries to kill that woman out of jealousy. But Sirima's rage is met by that woman with an amazing display of equanimity, grounded in Buddhist values. And Sirima is really impressed, and she wants that equanimity. She wants to be like that other woman. She becomes a patron of the Buddhist Sangha at that woman's recommendation, and she really turns her life around. She begins to use her wealth. Her vocation is that of a courtesan, and she uses her wealth to feed many monks at her home every day. So she's really turned her life around, and the story of Sarama's conversion is a powerful story. But her story, as told in the Dhammapada Attakatha, goes in a very different direction. In the Dhammapada Attakatha, the monk has a meal at her home, and then Sirima dies that very day. Very conveniently, she dies on the day that this unnamed monk falls in love with her, eats at her home, sees her, and falls in love with her. She has a high fever during the day, and by the nighttime, she is dead. The Buddha tells the king that her body should not be cremated, that it should be placed in the cremation ground, but guarded from wild animals, and kept that way for 3 days. And then the Buddha also says that on the fourth day after her death, a proclamation should be made all over town that everyone should come see Sirma. Meanwhile, the monk himself is oblivious to all this. He's gone back to his cell in a lovelorn state, and he's not stirred the whole time. As far as he knows, Sirma is very much alive. So he hears the proclamation on the fourth day that all must come see Sirma. And he goes along with the crowd to the cremation ground, where the Buddha holds a bizarre auction. Sirma used to command 1,000 copper coins per night, and so the Buddha starts the bidding there. By dropping the price in gradual increments, the Buddha makes it clear that no man will have Sirma at any price. That's made evident to all spectators, especially the monk himself. So in the Dhammapada Attakatha, this is what the Buddha proclaims. In this very city, men used to pay 1,000 coins for the privilege of spending one night with this woman. Now there is no one who will take her even for free. Even the Buddha himself is depicted as a man who benefited from the sight of female bodies transformed in repulsive ways. Ashvaghosha includes a long set of verses in the Buddhacharita, a Sanskrit biography of the Buddha, that show how the sight of women's bodies distorted in sleep puts Gotama on the path to renunciation. The Bodhisattva sees the women in the women apartments, in the women's apartments, snoring and drooling during the night, and suddenly has the impression that he is in a cremation ground. Ashvaghosha is noteworthy for his masterful use of literary devices. He takes the conventions of Sanskrit poetry and really turns them on their head. The literary mood associated with erotic love is not supposed to be used in conjunction with the literary mood associated with death and destruction on the battlefield. But that is precisely what this masterful poet does in the Buddhacharita. He sets up a scene where there's a party in the women's apartments, a scene that's initially set up as an amorous scene using erotic literary conventions. But it gets weirder and weirder with each additional verse. With bodies that at first seem to be tired from dancing and lovemaking, starting to look like bodies with broken limbs, bodies that have been destroyed on the battlefield. And the erotic mood is gradually eclipsed by these images of destruction, making it possible for the reader or listener to understand that what appears erotic is much more complicated than it seems. This experience of sudden insight leads the Bodhisattva to take the path of renunciation. Similar transformations of erotic spaces are associated with other men in the post-Ashokan hagiographic record. For example, one of the first men to join the Sangha, a man named Yasa, has a similar aha experience in the women's apartments of his home. Like the Bodhisattva, he sees sleeping women with disheveled hair and clothes in disarray, and he's reminded of bodies in the cremation ground. Yasa ends up leaving his home in the middle of the night, just as the Bodhisattva did. Yasa goes to where the Buddha is staying, hears the teachings of the Buddha, and becomes an arahant right away. Now, some of the monks were curious about this. How did he attain so much in such a short time? And so they asked the Buddha about this. In the Dhammapada Attakatha, the Buddha explains, answers the inquiring monks by telling a past life story that shows how Yasa used to go around doing a charitable act. In the past, he used to go around with a group of men cremating bodies that had been abandoned in cremation grounds. And at one particular time, he had a moment of insight while cremating a pregnant corpse. So the Buddha says that's the foundation that Yasa was drawing on. There are other narratives that I could talk about, other narratives setting cremation ground settings that I could include in the discussion today. For example, there's a shockingly graphic narrative in the Divyavadana, in a Sanskrit text, about a woman who's punished for a crime by having her limbs cut off, and about a man who visits her in that bloody condition, saying, "I want to see her body in its true form." But that's a complicated story that we don't have time for today. Follow the Buddha's teachings. Chittahata's story is a great inspiration. No one thought that this man would manage to stay in the Sangha, much less become an arahant. But he was able to achieve that lofty goal thanks to a shock that he received from seeing his wife asleep one day. The Buddha of the Dhammapada Attakatha paints a very delightful satirical picture of this monk. He's ironically named Tera Chittahata. But put to work as an assistant to more senior monks, Chittahata resents this imposition and returns home to his wife. After a few days of tending the forest fields at home, however, Chittahata misses the relative ease of monastic life. So he puts his plowing implements away, and he dons his robes, and leaves home, and is again received into the Sangha. The same pattern recurs 6 times in succession. On his 7th return to the householder's life, Chittahata repeats the usual pattern, where he works for a while, then decides he's tired of working in the fields, and figures he might as well go back to the monastery. He goes to the bedroom where he stored his saffron robe. His wife is taking a nap there in the bedroom. And now Chittahata sees that she has become pregnant. He looks at her and he sees her body. It appears to him like a corpse. It looks distorted and very different. He says to him, Chittahata's indecisiveness disappears the moment that he perceives his wife as a swollen corpse. In narratives that feature transformed female bodies, the alteration of the woman's body is often the key to eradicating the man's desire. Although it's technically not the woman, but the man's deluded ideas about her that are responsible for his desire, nevertheless, the destruction of her beauty often suffices to destroy his desire. Thus, Chittahata's delusions dissolve when his wife's appearance is so radically altered by sleep that he cannot continue to view her as desirable. That a woman's altered appearance can extinguish a man's desire once and for all is suggested not only by Chittahata, but also by his mother-in-law in this narrative. She goes inside, when she sees him running away, she goes inside to see what has happened. She sees her daughter asleep, and she smacks her, and she says, "Get up, you wench. Your husband saw you asleep, became remorseful, and left. He will never be your husband again." Meanwhile, Chittahata goes back to the monastery, and his fellow monks laugh at him and call him a blockhead. They predict that he'll leave in a few days, but instead, he becomes an arahant. So now I will turn to questions about how women might have experienced the sort of narrative that I've been talking about. How would female listeners have situated themselves within such narratives? Would gendered conventions of looking have influenced women as consumers of literature? Would these conventions have influenced women's self-understanding as subjects? We know that in secular literature, readers have complex relationships with fictional characters. A reader might see herself in the principal character of a story, might see that protagonist as a version of herself. But she might not. Not all protagonists invite identification. But I would suggest that in hagiographies, identifying with the protagonist is important. If hagiographies teach us to be Buddhists in our subject formation and to internalize Buddhist values, then it makes sense for us to use our imaginations to identify with the main character. Now, for heterosexual men, the process of identifying with some of the male protagonists that I've talked about today seems fairly straightforward. It would not be difficult for such a man to see a monk like Kula or Chittahatta as a version of himself. Perhaps with his necrophilia, Kula is an extreme that not every heterosexual male could identify with, but still it's within the realm of possibility. But I wonder how women of the post-Ashokan era would have used their imaginations in hearing stories about monks like Kula. Would they identify with the man who becomes an arahant through looking at a woman's body? Would they identify themselves with the woman whose body he's looking at? Or would they somehow identify with both? That is to say, would a woman be able to situate herself in the narrative by occupying both locations, that of the male protagonist who's doing the looking, and that of the female whose body is observed? One way to approach the question is to examine the concept of the gendered gaze in visual media. By analyzing visual culture, the idea of the gaze articulates how the audience views the people presented in a visual medium, such as painting or cinema. So let's take a brief look at theories of the gaze as developed in art history and film theory. John Berger was one of the first scholars to analyze conventions of looking and the way that these can be gendered. In the 1960s and 70s, he wrote about the positioning of the female body in painting as a fetishized object of the male gaze. He argued that in the art of European masters from the Renaissance onwards, the ideal spectator is male. Pictures that feature women tend to be organized around the female body as a sight to be seen. One of the formulations that Berger made famous is the statement that men act and women appear. That is to say that while men are engaged in action in the art of European masters, women are present as sights to be seen. This to-be-seenness is particularly clear in the case of the nude. The example that you have gives you an instance of this. Berger says that female nudes painted by European masters reflect the fact that in the era of their production, most of the owners of the paintings were male, and the implied viewer is male. Berger gives the example of this painting. This is The Allegory of Time and Love by Bronzino. It was sent as a present from the Grand Duke of Florence to the King of France. Venus, in the center of the painting, is presented to the viewer with her body arranged in a very peculiar way. She's engaged in the act of kissing with Cupid, the boy on the left. But the way her body is arranged has nothing to do with the act of kissing, Berger says, and everything to do with the implied male spectator in front of the picture. He is the principal protagonist. He's never painted, although the whole scene is addressed to him. It is for him that the figures are posed in the way that they are. Writing in the 1970s, Laura Mulvey popularized the term male gaze in film theory. Her analysis of cinematic viewing practices focuses on the way on who is doing the looking in cinema. Mulvey uses examples from classical Hollywood cinema to suggest that many films construct an ideal cinematic subject or viewer of films, and that implied subject is a heterosexual male. The cinematic apparatus constructs the woman on the screen as the object of male desire by the way that the camera positions her. Viewers are encouraged by the camera work to identify with the implied male spectator. Since the time of Berger and Mulvey, more subtle accounts of gendered viewing practices have emerged. Critics, for example, have objected to the tendency in both Berger and Mulvey to treat the male gaze as a homogeneous essence. Those who've offered more complex accounts of the way that spectatorship is structured reject the idea that there's only one kind of spectator, male, and only one kind of masculinity, heterosexual. They've argued that both women and men can adopt the cinematic gaze. The male is not always the controlling subject, nor is the female always the passive object. Teresa de Laurentiis has made especially helpful contributions in theorizing the female spectator. She's argued that the female spectator does not simply adopt a masculine subject position. To be a female spectator involves what De Laurentiis describes as double identification that incorporates both male and female aspects. I'm going to offer this advertisement as a visual illustration of the split subjectivity of the female gaze. Notice that the female body is, the female model is looking at us. Her gaze is active, suggesting agency. But she's framed by the camera as a sight to be seen. The model who holds her in his arms reinforces that pictorial framing of her as an object of desire. As I read the image, she's a split subject. She's aware of herself as a subject who looks and acts, but she's also aware of herself as a sight to be seen. She has the active gaze of one who looks and the passivity of one who is seen. In thinking about how women might have situated themselves in the literary milieu of the post-Ashokan era, I suggest that it would be advantageous to imagine oneself in the place of a male spectator, a male protagonist who achieves insight into the nature of things as they really are. But it would have been difficult to identify purely with the male protagonist without also identifying with the female bodies that serve as objects of contemplation. For women to assume the place of the protagonist or subject would, I think, entail a double identification. Women would be aware of themselves as sights to be seen, but also as spectators doing the seeing. To situate themselves within these narratives would entail a split subjectivity that combines male and female sites of identification. I find evidence of double identification in some hagiographies about famous nuns composed in the post-Ashokan era. These narratives show women achieving insight by looking at female bodies, their own, or in some cases those of other women. In these narratives, women awaken as arahants by seeing female bodies transformed by disease and death. Encounters with such transformed female bodies seem to me to be as much a watershed moment for nuns in their hagiographies as they are for monks in their hagiographies. And just as in stories of monks, likewise here we see the Buddha lending his authority to such practices by conjuring up female bodies for women to contemplate. Commentaries attributed to Dhammapala and Buddhaghosa tell such stories. Biographical collections like the Teri Apadana contain such stories. I'll start with some examples from Dhammapala's commentary on the Teri Gata. Dhammapala mentions a number of cases where monks teach nuns to use their own bodies as a basis for contemplation. In several instances, the monks in question were the sons of these nuns. Abhaya Mata is an example of this type of narrative. Abhaya Mata was a courtesan, one who was famous enough to attract the interest of King Bimbisara, with whom she had a son. Her son was named Abhaya, and he took ordination and achieved awakening. She took ordination after him and was his pupil. Abhaya instructed his mother to use her body as a basis for meditation. She attained awakening through following her son's instruction, and these two verses from the Teri Gata represent what he taught her and how she learned. I am, by the way, using Charles Hallisey's excellent translation of the Teri Gata here. I've translated portions of the text myself, but I'm not skilled enough to reproduce in English the meter of the Pali. And this is something that Hallisey deems important to understanding how the poetry works. So returning to the story, Abhaya's mother learned from her son to use her body as a focus for meditation. And Dhammapala's commentary says that she became an arahant through the practice. Time doesn't permit me to include the similar case of Ambapali, who also gained insight after hearing a teaching from her son. You may be familiar with the 19 verses attributed to her in the Teri Gata on the decrepit state of her body in old age. Another nun who was taught to use her body as a support for meditation is the nun Vimala. She tried to seduce Mahamoggallana, one of the disciples of the Buddha famous for his mastery of supernormal powers. Dhammapala tells her story in his commentary to the Teri Gata and indicates there that some think that she was hired by non-Buddhist rivals who wanted to make the Buddhists look bad. In any case, Mahamoggallana did not respond to Vimala's overture with desire, but instead gave her an anatomy lesson. He was evidently not a man who minces words. He said something like this: "You bag of dung tied up with skin, you demoness with lumps on your breast. There are 9 streams in your body which flow all the time. Your body with its 9 streams makes an evil smell and is obstructed by dung. A monk desiring purity avoids it as one avoids excrement." His words motivated Vimala to take up the monastic life. Dhammapala indicates that she made great effort and became an arahant after a very short time. Here are some of the verses that are attributed to Vimala. In what Vimala is reported to have said, I see evidence of double identification. There's the statement of her accomplishments, an assertion of her agency, but also a keen awareness of herself as an object of sight. You can especially see that in these early verses. Her verses illustrate the self-referential nature of female spectatorship. So she talks about how she was seen, how she presented herself, and how she created illusions for people. And then in the last 2 verses, what she has achieved, her current condition. Next, I will briefly mention narratives that show the Buddha creating female apparitions to teach lessons to vain nuns. Post-Ashokan literary tradition records several instances of prideful nuns who were taught a lesson in humility by the Buddha. There are 2 sets of similar verses in the Teri Gata that Buddhist tradition associates with 2 different women. One set of verses is attributed to a nun called Sundari Nanda, and the other to a nun called Abhirupa Nanda. Both names have adjectives meaning beautiful and the word Nanda meaning enjoyment, with the implication that these are persons who are beautiful women, enjoyable to look at. The Teri Gata verses are very similar. Alice Collette suggests that while texts composed after the Therigatha attempt to delineate two discrete women with separate biographies, the attempt was ultimately not successful, and the two were subsequently recapitulated into one. So following Collette's lead, I'll treat the various narratives as narratives about a single woman. What unites all the narratives about Nanda is the theme of taking pride, great pride in beauty, and how the Buddha intervenes and creates an apparition of a beautiful woman to teach the young woman a lesson. That apparition undergoes rapid aging, death, and decay. One place where the story of Nanda appears in a fully developed form is in the Dhammapada Attikatha, in a section of biographical backstories behind the Buddha's verses on Jara, a term that means old age and decay. There she's given the name Rupa Nanda, and she's introduced as the sister of the Buddha, the daughter, the natural daughter of Mahaprajapati Gotami, the Buddha's aunt and adoptive mother. So in this story, Nanda ordains because she doesn't want to be left behind. Everyone else in her immediate family has become a monk or a nun, and she kind of feels some social pressure to join monastic life. But she's not really into it. And she avoids the Buddha. She doesn't go to hear the Buddha teach. She's heard that he's not so keen on physical beauty, and she thinks, oh, he'll criticize me. I should stay away. But eventually she decides she'll go hear him. And he plans a lesson for her that day. He creates the appearance of a 16-year-old woman dressed in red, fanning herself. And that gets Nanda's attention. Nanda looks at this beautiful woman, takes in every feature, and then the Buddha starts this process of gradually aging her. So causes the girl's body to age a couple of years, and notices that Nanda is immediately displeased by this. The Buddha then caused the woman to take the appearance of a middle-aged woman, and then the appearance of a toothless, hunchbacked old woman leaning on a walking stick. And from there, the Buddha pushed the lesson to its logical conclusion. The apparition falls to the ground and dies, immediately bloating up with putrefaction and maggots. And then crows and other scavengers descend on the apparition. These words on the slide depict the powerful effect that this sight has on Rupa Nanda. From the last sentence, you can see how effective it was. Her mind flew toward its object of meditation. She suddenly really understands. There are a number of different versions of this narrative. We don't have time to look at the different versions, but I recommend one Apadana version of the story where the phantom woman is bitten by a poisonous spider, and that's a very graphic version of the story. Since we're running short on time, let me turn to the last type of narrative about nuns that I want to talk about today, and that is nuns who use their own bodies to teach others, who use their bodies as examples of the true nature of reality. Some of the most extensive sets of verses in the Therigatha are reserved for two nuns who use their own bodies as teaching tools to help others achieve insight. These nuns are represented as very effective teachers. One avoids an unwanted arranged marriage, and the other prevents the possibility of rape. Both use their bodies as props to help others appreciate the reality of impermanence. So the first one to discuss is Sumedha. She's incredibly eloquent and very persuasive. Her verses appear last in a compilation arranged in ascending order of complexity, and they constitute an elaborate and moving argument for maintaining chastity in the face of societal pressure to marry and reproduce. Sumedha has been taking instruction from local nuns for a couple of years when she hears that her parents have arranged her marriage. And on the day that the wedding party is to arrive, she goes in a room, she cuts off her hair, and she sort of imitates the tonsure ceremony of entering the monastic order. When the wedding party arrives, she's ready for them. She explains to all the guests in great detail the foulness and impermanence of the body, holding her locks of hair in her hands. These two verses give you an idea of the anatomy lesson that she shares with the crowd that's assembled there. She's so eloquent and her passion is so clear that everyone in attendance becomes a Buddhist at the end of her speech, and she was able to take her chosen path as a nun. The other nun that I'll mention is Suba. She was a nun who used to visit a certain mango grove in the afternoons, taking advantage of this quiet spot for her midday rest. One day, a wicked young man followed her and cornered her there, suggesting his ability to use physical force to overcome her resistance. She asked him what he could possibly want to do with a body as disgusting as hers, and he says, "Ah, lady, it's your beautiful eyes." So she gives him an elaborate anatomy lesson, focusing on the eye, and then she removes her eye and hands it to him. An example of what she says. When she removes her eye, it has an immediate effect, and he begs her forgiveness. And later, her eye is restored when she went to see the Buddha. You could say that both women do a literary version of self-dissection. They hold pieces of themselves in their hands and verbally dissect themselves and direct the gaze of their audience to the foulness inside. They're extremely effective in their persuasive powers, I suggest, because they understand how many people in their audience need to see the abstract lessons of the Dhamma illustrated in concrete form in order to achieve some sort of insight. These narratives strike me as good examples of the split subjectivity that feminist film theorists talk about. They show women as protagonists who achieve opposition, who overcome opposition and accomplish their aims. But they achieve their aims by drawing the gaze of others to themselves. They assert themselves as women who have something to say. They occupy the position of speaking subjects. But they do so by using their bodies as stage props. This suggests to me the kind of double identification that's typical of the female spectator in film theory. After I published Charming Cadavers, I got a very thoughtful email from Venerable Analeo saying that he'd found a male counterpart to Suba and was preparing an article for publication. Venerable Analeo drew my attention to some errors that I'd made in what I'd written about Suba, and he asked if he had characterized my work correctly, which he had. I was grateful to have been given the chance to comment in advance of publication, and I've learned a lot from our correspondence over the years. So in conclusion, as my final example, I'll give some details on the narrative that Bhikkhu Analeo found. This narrative makes it clear that in the world of Buddhist narrative, it's not only females who are imagined to gouge out their eyes. This narrative is found in the Ekutarika Agama collection in Chinese, and I've quoted from Bhikkhu Analaya's translation here. The story goes that there's a Pacheka Buddha, a solitary Buddha named Beautiful Eyes. A young woman propositions him. He plucks out his eye and gives it to the woman and gives her an anatomy lesson about it. She realizes her error and apologizes, and he says, No, it's not your fault. The fault is mine. It's because of my offenses done in the past that I have received this body. On seeing it, people arouse sentiments of sensuality. Bhikkhu Analeo suggests that this narrative stands in contrast to what Bernard Faure sees as a pattern in Buddhist texts, where, quote, in a man, beauty is often perceived as the effect of good karma, whereas in a woman, it's usually seen as the result of past sin. One noteworthy aspect of this narrative, I think, is the fact that this is a Pacheka Buddha. Pacheka Buddhas are different from other Buddhism that they don't teach the Dhamma directly. They teach the Dhamma by means of the body and not by means of words. So I think this is interesting, and it aligns them with the women in the narratives that I've talked about. It's a very logical choice, I think, to cast a Pacheka Buddha in this role. Like the nuns Suba and Sumedha, Pacheka Buddhas tend to rely on their bodies as a teaching tool. This example raises a question of whether there are other narratives out there, perhaps yet to be translated, that focus on the male body as an object for the female gaze. If others know of examples, please share them with us. I'd be very interested to know. And I know I'm running out of time. I'm going to conclude very briefly by raising some questions about the historical context behind these stories. Just to say that the post-Ashokan era was one in which Buddhism became very successful. Of course, you know, there was a fluctuation in the fortunes of Buddhism during this era, but overall, Buddhism moved from a counterculture to more of a dominant cultural force. My theory about these stories, why they were prominent, is that celibacy became important as a bulwark against people who wanted to join the Sangha but whose motives were not so sincere. It was a time when one could easily use the Sangha as a stepping stone to a successful secular career. So my theory was that celibacy became important as a means of discouraging those who were not sincere and really reinforcing the importance of remaining socially disengaged. But I have to tell you, I'm rethinking this explanation in the light of Shane Clark's work on the what different Vinaya accounts have to say about the place of family ties in Indian Buddhist monasteries. I'm rethinking what social engagement means, with the many examples of married couples practicing co-renunciation and other ways in which monasteries accommodated family life. So I am, as many other people, I think, rethinking that of his history. And now I apologize for taking so much time. Let's open it up for discussion. I'm eager to hear what you might have to say. Let's see. There's a statement here. It's noteworthy that the Buddha encouraged Kula to establish a Supasana on a female corpse, while the Visuddhimagga maintains that one shouldn't use the body of the opposite sex for a Supa Kamatana. Yes, I think that is interesting, suggesting that the ideal sometimes has to be violated for the effective cure, I suppose. I find that interesting, too. So there's a comment that double identification seems equally well explained by a culture in which men who have power relative to women cling to the female's role for their pleasure, and women who need sources of power cling to their female body's ability to bring power through attractiveness to men. When a young woman breaks through denial about unavoidable loss of her social position gained by her beauty, it brings great shock. Yes, this suggests that there's a dynamic here, I think. Riko Onuma asks, what do you make of the mother-son dynamic in some of these stories, which is so odd and somewhat disturbing? Is it a subtle way for the son to deny or denigrate his origin from his mother? Or would you read it more charitably as the son acknowledging his tie to his mother by being the one who brings about her realization of impermanence, etc.? Yes, I do find this odd and disturbing in some ways. It obviously, by placing the mother in the place of pupil, it would suggest at some level a denigration of her status. But I also do think that it is an expression of what may have been a reality, which is, again, as Shane Clark has suggested, family ties were still strong in monastic settings. And it would be natural, I think, to go to a family member for instruction. So, yes, I think the answer is both. It is disturbing, but it is at some level easily understandable. I have a question for some of the ordained folks here. I'm curious about for those of you who've read Shane Clark's work, I'm curious about your thoughts about his findings. If it's true that in Indian Buddhist history, social ties were stronger in monastic life than we have been led to believe, I'm wondering what implications that might have for the path of ordained Buddhists today. I'm wondering if anyone has any thoughts about that. Here's another response. Ah, yes. It aligns with the social norm of the woman becoming dependent on the son when she has no father or husband. Right. So by becoming a nun, you have severed yourself from, presumably, your husband and your father, and the son would be a natural guardian figure to go to. That does make sense. I'm also, though, intrigued by the findings of scholars who suggest that this language in the Laws of Manu actually comes later. It postdates Buddhism, and I think I made the mistake in writing Charming Cadavers of assuming that the Laws of Manu was something that was available, would have been known to Buddhists composing these the narratives. And I think a lot of good work has been done showing that much of these ideas about guarding women may have been in response to the very powerful, independent, autonomous Buddhist nuns and other heterodox nuns, that they would have been very much on the minds of those composing the Dharma Shastras. So I think it's interesting to ask questions about causality here and to what extent Buddhists would have actually been aware of such norms, to what extent Buddhists would have been creating the conditions for Brahmanical folks to worry about strong, powerful, independent women. So Bhikkhu Anālayo says regarding Shane Clark's book that he's expressed some disagreements with aspects of his approach in Bhikkhu Anālayo's article on the mass suicide of monks. The basic point is certainly right. Lack of awareness of the family dimension of monastic life is something that has gone out of focus in previous academic study. And here I would agree, take it to have been less dramatic than it may appear on reading Shane's book. Yes, I think to a certain extent Clark was trying to make his case and overcome some of the stereotypes out there and may have overstated the case a bit. Another comment, I see that even nowadays it's particularly difficult for young Chinese men to go forth in order to become monks. Family ties in Chinese families are much stronger compared to the average Western family. Interesting comment. Hard to know. It's hard to generalize, I would think, especially in, not knowing the particulars of social location for different folks. Biko Analeo writes, coming back to Asuba, you say that you're concerned with post-Ashoka material, so my comment does not really apply to what you said, but I wonder if Asuba already at the early canonical stage refers to the contemplation of corpses. Seems to me that at least at an early stage it refers to the contemplation of the anatomical parts. The Satipatthana Sutta has both exercises without the use of the term Asuba. Definition of perception of Asuba in Anguttara Nikaya 1060 lists the anatomical parts summed up as contemplation of Asuba. It seems only by the time of the Visuddhimagga that the contemplation of corpses is identified as the example par excellence for Asuba. Interesting. Well, I guess I'd always assume that the anatomical perception of body parts is something that came about through spending time in cremation grounds. That it was because of this kind of site of observation that Buddhist monastics would have learned as much as they did about the anatomy of the body. That's the argument about the role that Buddhist monastics made in the development of medical practices in India, that they were early practitioners of dissection, for example. But yes, I guess it makes sense that one could still visualize the anatomy of the body without necessarily going to the cremation ground. Here's another comment about family ties in Chinese Buddhism. Chinese entry in monasticism is presented as joining a new family, the monastic one, with Confucian structures in operation, such as the abbot as father and abbess as mother. And one becomes part of a specific monastery / family rather than roaming around different communities so easily. Yes. Yes, the idea of the Tantra father, right? All of the men that are ordained by the particular abbot would be considered to be Tantra brothers serving under a Tantra father. And when it came to ancestor tablets in the monastery, you would have your monastic fathers represented there. So yes, that does make sense, the sort of family ties represented being as kind of alternate to the biological family. And I don't know as much about nunneries and about the role of abbesses as mothers. That may be something that Reiko could comment on. Sounds like something in her wheelhouse. Here's another comment, monastic names reflect belonging to a certain monastic generation under a master. Right, the Tantra father and his sons. Right, it makes a lot of sense to me to have some structuring principles within monastic life, something that would give structure and authority to certain social configurations. Biko Analeo says, I take the contemplation of corpses to be originally predominantly about awareness of mortality. Knowing anatomy would be possible through medical knowledge in general. One need not have a corpse for that, although having one is, of course, very helpful. Right. Right. Anatomy can be in service of medical learning, certainly. And one can learn about anatomy by seeing how various medicines react to the body, for example. So, response here. You'll be amused that one time an elder revered Asian monk was teaching a group of Americans using the metaphor of danger of attraction to a young, beautiful 16-year-old, being her impermanence, her future decay. And then in a nod to the women present, he said that for women, of course, one would imagine an attractive 16-year-old man. He was surprised by our peals of helpless laughter at the thought of us being attracted to a teenager. One cannot simply reverse the gender to convey these kind of lessons, right? Right, I think that is funny. Not necessarily easily flipped. Attractive but not attractive as written. Yes. Yes, there's something kind of, when you think of a 16-year-old male, there's a different response. Rico Onuma writes, on a different topic, I've been working on a book on animals. Oh, wonderful. And it strikes me that in the Balabhapandita Sutta, the horrors of the animal realm are conveyed through vivid descriptions of their eating, chewing grass, etc. I wonder if animals are also objects that illustrate impermanence, impurity, etc., like women. But since animals are hopefully not objects of sexual temptation, but rather objects of gustatory temptation, there's a focus on their eating rather than on their bodies. Yes, that is very interesting. I like that a lot. I suppose you know the article by Alice Collette on Ashvaghosha, where she looks at different images of animals within Pali text, but gives kind of a typology of different animals. But yes, that makes a lot of sense to focus on them as objects of gustatory pleasure and that what they eat could also have ramifications for our desire to eat them. It sounds like a great book. I'm looking forward to reading it. One perspective is to identify neither with the male nor the male gaze, but simply working with the transformative perception and process of looking at the key characteristic, asubha, not self, death, etc., in question. From a meditative perspective, that is the gaze of a practitioner. Yes, it seems to me that the ideal here would be to have a non-gendered gaze. And in fact, I think some folks have made some good arguments for how hagiographies do construct a non-gendered gaze, how gender becomes irrelevant. I think in the examples that I've chosen today, gender comes to the foreground, but other examples of hagiography show that for both men and women, it's possible to transcend gender altogether. And I think this is something that third wave feminism is actually very good at, showing how the how to overcome the gender binary and think very broadly about taking a perspective that is beyond conventional sort of binary divisions of gender. So yes, thank you for that comment. I do think it's possible and desirable. So a comment to Reiko on the Bala Pandita Sutta. Well, it looks like that may be all the comments for today. If that is the case, I want to thank you for your interesting comments. It'll give me a lot to think about. Ah, here's one more thing. What is the thought of celibacy being socially disengaged? I think that it is detached, but not disengaged. Yeah, say more about that. What is the difference between detached and disengaged, I wonder? Not attached to the physical personal connection, but connected to the interdependency. Okay. So you still have a relationship to that person, but you're not invested in that person as sort of being the, you know, what gives meaning to your life or something like that. That makes sense. Looks like Anagarika Michelle has more to say. In any case, yes, it makes sense to me that these relationships, these social relationships, are absolutely fundamental, hard to avoid. And they do provide us a structuring principle in any social structure, in outside monasteries and inside monasteries. So if one can achieve a new way of relating to others, former spouses, brothers, sisters, parents, that would make sense. So yes, detachment but not disengagement. in Orthodox Theravada Buddhism, monks are supposed to be socially detached as well as disengaged. The latter is easier to achieve, though. So disengagement is easier to achieve than detachment. I guess I can see that. Yes, I guess it does make sense. Easier not to be socially engaged. Right. One is a matter of role performance and the other is a matter of mental state. Yes, that makes sense. Although presumably they reinforce each other. Just physical abstention, mental disenchantment is more difficult to achieve. Yes. Right, so one would be an avoidance behavior, but not necessarily a change in the state of mind. Mental disenchantment, as you say. Yes, that makes sense. Oh, I realize I didn't show my sources. I should probably do that. Are there other comments? Not living by worldly aims, yet dependent on the care of others, requires separation and yet connection. How this is achieved may be strongly influenced by the cultural norms of the time. Yes. Yes, that's tricky. When you're dependent on the care of others, you certainly have to be aware of expectations, separation, and yet connection. Is there any resource on how this may have evolved as Buddhism has spread through time and place? Yes, so you're talking about different cultural norms for how one understands the social relationship. I think there are some interesting examples of work out there. I'm interested in, like Reiko, interested in sons and mothers, and I think Alan Cole's work on sons and mothers in Chinese Buddhism is a great example of a sort of cultural inflection on family ties, and particularly Cole talks about the way that for sons living in monasteries, worries about mothers continue to shape their formation as monks. So thinking about, for example, deceased mothers and how they may be suffering in hell because of actions done in the past. It seems that, from what Cole has to say, that's a major theme in Chinese Buddhism. And it definitely goes to the statement that someone made earlier about contemporary China and the strong role of family ties there. So that would be one example. Although Cole definitely draws on Indian sources in kind of setting up his study, he draws on some examples from India and makes some comparative comments that might be worth looking at. You're welcome. Well, again, thank you for your comments. I think our time is coming to an end. I certainly appreciate your logging in and appreciate your taking the time. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. It's a nice group.
Recording is off.
Recording is off.